Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Bronwyn Knotson. I'm the Clerk Assistant Procedure here in the Department of the Senate. And on behalf of Dr. Rosemary Lane, Clerk of the Senate, I'd like to welcome you to November's seminar series. We're very excited today to have Kylie Scroop, the Director of Art Services here in Parliament House, as our speaker today. I think even as you've walked into the committee room today, you'll agree that the art collection held by Parliament House is a magnificent treasure, and as a parliamentary officer I can vouch that it's a wonderful privilege to work in amongst wonderful artefacts each day. Kylie joined here in Parliament House in early 2007, having joined us from the National Archives and a distinguished career in a number of Canberra's premier cultural institutions. She's an expert in her field, and more excitingly, this is the first time that we've ever had a parliamentary officer present in our Senate seminar series. So we are very much looking forward to Kylie's presentation. And without further ado, over to Kylie.
Thank you, Bronwyn, and thank you all for being here today. The 22nd of December 2011 marks the centenary of the first national art collection established by the Commonwealth of Australia, the Historic Memorials Collection. The establishment of the collection in 1911 also set in place the foundations of other important collecting institutions such as the National Gallery of Australia and the National Portrait Gallery. Today I intend to outline a brief history of the establishment of the collection and then look at a selection of portraits from the collection, including some rarely seen publicly that are currently being exhibited to celebrate this centenary. The story of the HMC is also a story about the intersection of art and politics, and the importance of this connection was never more evident than in the period leading up to the establishment of the collection in 1911. 100 years ago, Australia was still very much a new nation, and to properly understand the origins of the HMC, we need to look back on the preceding decades, particularly the period leading up to Federation in 1901. The Federation movement was marked by dissent and the competing priorities and interests of the separate colonies, but had arisen out of a growing sense of idealised national identity in the late 19th century. One of its key proponents, the future Prime Minister Alfred Deakin, said that Federation must always appear to have been secured by a series of miracles. Australian constitutional historian Helen Irving has written convincingly about how the people of the states first had to imagine the idea of a nation called Australia before that nation could exist. That process of imagining the country into existence occurred at a number of levels. The drafters of the Australian Constitution, for the most part lawyers and politicians, built support for their cause on a sense of common identity that was very much about promoting allegiance to a vision of a dominant white British culture and convincing their constituents that in uniting the colonies, the freedom and economic security of the new nation would be assured. With the benefit of hindsight, we can say that they seem largely to have gotten it right. However, as we know, politicians promising a brighter future will not necessarily automatically win public support. I want to quickly divert here to reflect on two names that keep recurring when you examine the origins of the HMC. On the political side, Alfred Deakin, and on the artistic side, Tom Roberts. The possible points of connection between these two men, and to a lesser extent some of the other major players who were their colleagues in art and politics at that time, are intriguing. On the surface, Roberts and Deakin appear to have quite a lot in common. Deakin was born in 1856 in Collingwood, Melbourne. Roberts was also born in 1856 in Dorset, England, and came to live in Collingwood, Melbourne at the age of 13. Both men liked to read and write and moved in literary and artistic circles. Deakin also became engaged with spiritualism and philosophy. Both eventually became leaders in their fields, acting as teachers and mentors to others in their circle, and they worked hard to promote causes that they passionately believed in. Deakin's biographer, J.A. Lanaus, suggests that Roberts and Deakin probably first met in 1901 while Tom Roberts was working on his big picture, which I will talk more about later. But I find it tempting to speculate that they could have met earlier. Melbourne was certainly a much smaller place then than it is now, and I haven't found any historical references suggesting that they met often, but they definitely corresponded regularly over a period of more than 10 years. Lanao's notes that their letters indicate a friendly informality and suggest that they each regarded the other as an intellectual peer. By far the most striking thing that they shared in common was an enthusiasm for documenting and reporting on the characters and events of their time. Deacon wrote extensively throughout his life, keeping diaries and notebooks, and his writings about the Federation movement include character studies of many of the leading figures of that time, which provide insight into the processes that were at work. Roberts, through his painting, also attempted to capture some of the history of the evolution of the nation and made many portrait character studies, similarly attempting to capture a record of types. For instance, Robert did a set of portraits in the 1890s, which he titled The Church, the Law and the State, each depicting prominent leaders in those three fields of endeavour. But returning again to Helen Irving's theme of imagining the nation, the efforts of the Federationists in capturing the public imagination were substantially assisted by the creative and sporting elements of society. Irving writes about the flowering of a distinctively nationalist literature, poetry, and music, as well as distinctive sporting culture. Visual arts also played a vital role, and none more so than the members of what we now know as the Heidelberg Group of Artists, also known as the Australian Impressionists. I'm not sure how well you can see these slides. I'm sorry it's a little bit bright in here, but basically that's a portrait of Nellie Melba on the left and a depiction of one of the first cricket matches between Australia and England. Irving notes that the movements for political and cultural nationalism were inevitably in advance of popular demand. They were led at the start by a small elite circle whose quest was to forge a distinctive Australian national character out of diffuse British references and leanings. Irving doesn't name the members of this elite circle, but I'm reasonably confident that she might have included Alfred Deakin and Tom Roberts as part of their number. Interestingly, another one of the players in this group was J.F. Archibald, who was one of the founders and managers of the Bulletin, which again played a major part in sort of shaping public imagination in the period leading up to Federation. And also, curiously, he left the bequest in his will that led to the foundation of the Archibald Prize. So there's another connection there between journalism, popular idealism, and portraiture. In 1894, Tom Roberts' colleague, the artist Arthur Streeton, wrote in a Federalist journal, Commonwealth, that it seemed as though Federation were unconsciously begun by the artists and national galleries. Certainly, he and his peers articulated a new representation of Australian landscape and people through some of their key works of the 1880s and 1890s. While undoubtedly influenced by European Impressionist art, theirs was a different kind of artwork. Through their conscious depiction of harsh, hot sunlight, bleached colours, and sparse and spindly Australian vegetation, they purposefully set out to create a new, uniquely Australian style of art. We can see this exemplified in paintings such as Near Heidelberg, which you can see here, painted by Arthur Streeton in 1890, and Charles Condor's Summer Idyll of 1889. Likewise, they celebrated the characteristically Australian form of human endeavour and helped mythologise the notion of the Australian bush character, shaped by the hardships that faced those who settled in it. For example, Frederick McCubbin's painting Down on His Luck of 1889 and A Breakaway, painted by Tom Roberts in 1891. Eventually, the grand vision of the federal movement was realised and the new nation of Australia came into existence on the 1st of January 1901 in Centennial Park, Sydney, amid great ceremony and celebration. The enthusiasm of the January celebrations in Sydney was echoed in Melbourne in May when the first parliament was opened by the Duke of Cornwall and York. Tom Roberts captured this moment in his epic history painting, colloquially known as The Big Picture, which hangs just outside this room where I'm speaking today. The Big Picture is not formally a part of the HMC. However, I believe that this painting and its creator Tom Roberts are such a critical component of the story of establishment of the HMC that they deserve a special mention. The painting was commissioned by a group of Melbourne businessmen who intended it as a gift to the new King, Edward VII. Roberts wasn't the first artist commissioned, but when the first choice, J.C. Waites, backed out, Roberts stepped in. He had to undertake a minimum of 250 individual portraits. Eventually, it turned out to be 269 individually named people. It took him over 2 years to complete the work. It required extensive travel in Australia and England and resulted in a monumental canvas at just over 5 metres by 3 metres. He completed the painting in 1904, whereupon it was presented to the King, and it remained in England in St James Palace until 1958. The painting was eventually returned to Australia following persistent lobbying from a number of parliamentary figures and is now on permanent loan to the Australian Parliament from the Royal Collection. The painting has received very mixed reviews over time. It certainly lacks the vitality and liveliness that's so engaging in some of Tom Roberts' individual portraits. It's also often cited as the catalyst for Roberts entering a very dark period in his artistic career. Roberts himself wrote in letters to friends about the effort it cost him to complete the work. However, he equally regarded it as something of a personal mission to record what he saw as a momentous occasion. Personally, I think it's been a little bit unfairly treated. True, it's a much darker and more sombre work than some of Roberts' other portraits, but he was accurately depicting the state of mourning of the guests attending the function. And I think that its scale and the volume of detail it contains are such that it requires very close study to be fully appreciated. Certainly in the 4 years I've worked in this building, I find it's a painting I can look at again and again, and the more time you spend looking at it, the more you see. It certainly demonstrates a great deal of technical mastery in maintaining accurate proportion, scale and perspective across such a vast group of figures. You can only just make it out here, but this is a photograph of Tom Roberts while he was working on it. And he basically went around measuring and recording things like weight and height of different people who he had to depict, so that when he juxtaposed all the figures together in the painting, their scale and proportion relative to each other was all accurate. So if there was a very tall person standing next to a very short person, he wasn't painting them when they were standing next to each other, but he managed to manage the scale and perspective so that it all makes sense when you see it as a finished portrait. Interestingly, both Tom Roberts and Frederick McCubbin were invited guests at the opening event, possibly in recognition of their role in shaping the public imagination of the new nation, and probably an indication of their continuing association with politics and their prominence in Melbourne society as artists. Tom Roberts did go on to paint two other portraits for the Historic Memorials Collection, one of the second Governor-General, Lord Tennyson, and a very late portrait of the poet Henry Kendall, which Roberts painted in 1926 when he was 70 years old, and Kendall had been dead for almost 40 years. It's a really lovely portrait, and it's actually included in one of the exhibitions that we've mounted for the centenary, so again, I would encourage you all to take a look at it. But moving forward, politicians got on with the business of governing, and the leading artists of the day attempted to consolidate their successes and pursue new artistic fields. Many of Australia's leading artists headed to Europe to try their fortune, with varying degrees of success. In the decade from 1901 to 1911, Australia had five different prime ministers, with Deakin serving three separate terms and Andrew Fisher serving two terms. Parliament passed the Immigration Restriction Act, Australian troops were sent to the Boer War, the High Court was established, the world's first feature film, The Kelly Gang, was made, and the US Navy's Great White Fleet visited Australia. Throughout that decade, the topic of appropriate recognition of the people and events associated with formation of the Commonwealth was periodically discussed in the new Parliament. One of the primary advocates for some form of commemoration was the artist Tom Roberts. Self-interest may have been part of his motivation, but no doubt his sincere belief in the importance of creating records for posterity, as demonstrated by his efforts in completing the big picture, was also a factor. Roberts wrote to Alfred Deakin in March 1910, "Let me ask you to consider the importance of acting early and let these records be painted to give faithful representations of the first leaders of the Commonwealth. It disturbs me to think that most of you are likely to go on till the inevitable comes and leave nothing that will give the future anything that will show what you all were as men to look at." Deakin subsequently sent a copy of Robert's letter to Prime Minister Andrew Fisher, who told the Parliament in October 1911 that the government hopes to preserve likenesses of the prominent statesmen of Australia. 2 months later, the Historic Memorials Committee was established as a committee of consultation and advice in reference to the expenditure of votes for the historic memorials of representative men, and the government allocated £500 for commencement of this work. I'd just like to comment briefly on the very specific gender reference here in relation to the collection. It is accurate in that the HMC is very much a collection about men. Almost all the portrait subjects are male, and almost all the artists commissioned to complete portraits have been male. The committee consisted of the Prime Minister of the day as chair, as well as the President of the Senate, Speaker of the House of Representatives, Vice President of the Executive Council, Leader of the Opposition, and the Leader of the Opposition in the Senate. The makeup of the committee is still the same today in 2011. One of their early actions was to agree on a list of eminent men whose portraits should be painted, with the first portrait to be that of Sir Henry Parkes, who had died before the Constitution took effect. They also recognised a need for specialist expertise and quickly established the Commonwealth Art Advisory Board to provide advice on the selection of suitable artists and to assess the quality of completed portraits. The establishment of the committee and the collection attracted considerable public interest and was not without controversy. The Sydney Morning Herald in September 1909, at that time Deakin was Prime Minister and Fisher Leader of the Opposition, said that Mr. Deakin is to be congratulated on his decision to make some provision for a gallery of national portraits. The form of words used by the Prime Minister in announcing this step, however, suggests a doubt as to whether he has in mind memorials to other than the political leaders of the federal movement. In August 1912, the Brisbane Courier took up a similar argument. By now it was Fisher's turn to be PM. "Some men are born to greatness, others have it thrust upon them, and others thrust it upon themselves. The Historic Memorials Committee, of which the Federal Prime Minister is chairman, has approved of a report of an art advisory board in connection with the perpetuation of the memories of Australia's great men. Some of the names of the list are quite correctly included, but quite a number have no claim yet to be classed with the immortals. Many of the great names are ignored. In vain one looks for something to suggest remembrance of great explorers, poets, or authors. They are ignored so that the politicians, big and little, may be glorified." To some extent, that's an accurate assessment in that the Historic Memorials Collection has primarily remained a collection focusing on political figures, although there have from time to time been other portraits included. But what does become apparent when you look at news clippings like these from that time is that there was also a bigger picture objective in mind, and that there was always an anticipation, I think, that a thing called the National Portrait Gallery would come into existence and that its scope would be much broader than just a collection of political portraits. But at this point, I want to shift from considering the general history of the Historic Memorials Collection to look at a selection of portraits from the collection. Firstly, we'll look at the portrait of Alfred Deakin by Frederick McCubbin, one of the first commissions undertaken. To me, perhaps the most surprising thing about this portrait is that it wasn't painted by Tom Roberts, given the apparent friendship that the two of them shared and their shared idealism. Roberts would seem to have been the obvious choice for the commission, but he was by then, like many other early Australian artists, living in England, and there had been quite a bit of controversy about the HMC using artists based in England rather than granting commissions to artists living in Australia. The Australian Dictionary of Biography entry for Deakin describes him as a memoirist, barrister, federationist, irrigationist, journalist, newspaper editor, land speculator, politician, and spiritualist. He was known as a skilled orator and is often credited for helping popularise the Federation cause. He's certainly a very likeable character, I think. He became Australia's second Prime Minister in 1903 and took a great interest in promoting the arts and literature. However, his political career apparently took a heavy toll and affected his health. By the time this portrait was painted, he was unwell, and some biographies suggest he may have been suffering the early stages of dementia. You can't see it very well in this reproduction, but if you look at the original portrait, one of the things that's quite apparent to me, at least, is that he does have a really tired look around his eyes. I think he was clearly feeling the stresses of the 10 years or 20 years of preceding work. McCubbin was an Australian-born artist, also of Melbourne origin, who worked closely with Tom Roberts, Arthur Streeton and Charles Conder in the 1880s and 90s. In the early 1900s, he was at the height of his artistic powers and he excelled as a landscape painter, but was also known to paint figures. His portrait of Deacon is typical of the earliest HMC portraits. It's a full-length, life-size portrait, so the original painting is actually very large, much taller than me. And is typically depicting its subject in a very sober and serious fashion, with little in the way of decorative or extraneous imagery, apart from an ornate gilded frame, which was still very popular in that period. The portrait of Deacon is McCubbin's only inclusion in the HMC, and it's currently on display at the National Portrait Gallery in an exhibition to celebrate the centenary, with three other early HMC portraits, including this portrait of Andrew Fisher, another key player in the establishment of the collection as Prime Minister, by Emmanuel Phillips Fox, the portrait of Henry Parkes by Julian Ashton, and unfortunately you can't see this at all well, but this is a truly remarkable painting, I think, of King Edward VII, painted by George Lambert in 1910 and later presented by his wife as a gift to the Historic Memorials Collection. I would strongly urge and encourage you all to take the time, if you can, to go to the Portrait Gallery and look at this painting. It's not had a lot of exhibition over the last 100 years, but it is quite a standout and remarkable thing. Time doesn't allow a comprehensive review of all the works in the collection, so instead I'll focus on some of the more significant portrait artists and some of the individual standout portraits in the collection. So William Dargy is an outstanding figure in Australian portraiture, with a career that started when he was very young in the 1930s and continued through most of the 20th century. Dargy is perhaps best known for his portrait of Queen Elizabeth II that we see here, which was painted in 1954. Very famous because she's wearing what was called the wattle dress, which she wore for a number of key functions when she first visited Australia. The painting wasn't commissioned by the Commonwealth, but was presented as a gift to the Historic Memorials Collection. Dargy won the Archibald Prize 8 times between 1941 and 1956. I'm pretty sure that's a record. And was also an official war artist during World War II. He painted in a style known as tonal realism and was significantly influenced by Max Meldrum and A.D. Colquhoun, who were both also represented in the Historic Memorials Collection. He also played an important role in arts administration and education, serving on many boards and councils. Most notably, he served as a long-term member and eventually chair of the Commonwealth Art Advisory Board, who, as I've already mentioned, were set up to advise the Historic Memorials Committee. During the 1950s and 60s, when Dargy was a member, the Commonwealth Art Advisory Board played a particularly important role in acquiring artworks for the National Collection. Most of those works are now held in the National Gallery Collection. In particular, one of the things that Dargy is remembered for is being one of the first people to promote the idea of collecting work from Papua New Guinea and Pacific Melanesian area. At that time, most of that sort of material culture would have been treated more as museum objects of ethnographic interest, but not of major artistic merit. And Dargy was very active in promoting the collection of that sort of work, some of which has just recently been exhibited at the gallery. In total, Dargy completed 11 portraits for the Historic Memorials Collection, a number that I think will probably never be eclipsed. His HMC subjects include Prime Ministers Arthur Fadden and John McEwen, Dame Enid Lyon, and Governors-General Sir William Slim and Lord Casey, as well as the famous painting of Queen Elizabeth II. Brian Westwood is another artist very well represented in the HMC. He's painted 8 portraits for the collection, and he was twice a winner of the Archibald Prize. I think he's a bit of a neglected figure in Australian art. I'm not sure if any of you have ever heard of him, but I don't think his name is widely known. He was largely self-taught, didn't start painting until he was well into his 30s. He travelled extensively and spent periods living in Europe and America. His work's usually described as photorealist, and he painted very finely detailed and meticulously realistic portraits. In teaching himself how to paint, he studied the work of old masters in Europe, particularly Velázquez. One of the things I find particularly engaging about Westwood's portraits is that he was one of the first HMC portrait artists to encompass a more personal dimension in the portraits, sometimes by including objects with personal associations, or by posing his subjects in more reflective and individual ways. For instance, we can see his beautifully painted portrait of Sir Magnus Cormac, a former President of the Senate, which was painted in 1973, and his portraits of Sir Anthony Mason, a Chief Justice, painted in 1992, and Justin O'Byrne, painted in 1976. Again, you can't really appreciate the detail that's here. I did include some enlargements, but I'm not sure how easy it is to see. The way he paints lace and the little details like the carnation on the seat are just very attractive to me. Robert Hannaford has completed 9 commissions for the Historic Memorials Collection, including a major work in 2001 that depicts the centenary sitting of Parliament in the Melbourne Exhibition Building, an homage to Tom Roberts's big picture and displayed alongside the big picture here in Parliament House. Hannaford's HMC portraits include Prime Minister Paul Keating, painted in 1997, and Governor-General Sir William Dean, painted in 2001. Unlike most of the other recent HMC portrait artists, Hannaford paints primarily from life, which requires his subjects to make themselves available for a week or more of portrait sittings, which is no easy feat when they're still in office. A lot more of the contemporary artists are quite happy to have, you know, just a brief sitting with their subject and then work primarily from photographs. But Hannaford has a particularly characteristic style, which you can see in these 2 examples. Doesn't include a lot of background decoration or detail, almost always paints people seated, very much a sort of front-on pose, so it's really all about focusing your attention on the face. HMC portraits have occasionally been entered in the Archibald Prize, and at least 3 times they have been winners. I'm going to show you 3 portraits now that represent different periods and different styles of portraiture. Firstly, we have Max Meldrum's 1939 winning portrait of Speaker George Bell. Max Meldrum was again a pioneer of this tonalist painting, as it was called, which William Dargie also practised. And I guess the most sort of obvious visual manifestation of that is that it's very much about the contrast between areas of light and dark. So you don't get the very finely rendered detail like you do in Brian Westwood's work. And in this particular example, you know, the sort of arrangement of the 2 pieces of white cuff and then his white collar and the slightly less white wig, again, are all really about drawing your attention to his face. Joshua Smith, in 1944, produced an Archibald-winning portrait of Speaker John Rosevere. This is another really interesting portrait. It's one of the earliest ones, I think, that includes these sort of elements of the trappings of office. Again, I'm not sure how clear that is on that image, but basically he's sitting at his desk. He's got a pile of correspondence in front of him. There's an inkwell there, the Bakelite telephone, which you probably can't see in the bottom right-hand corner, which I think is a lovely period detail and makes it very much an image of its time. And Clifton Pugh, in 1972, painted an Archibald Prize-winning portrait of Prime Minister Gough Whitlam. The Whitlam portrait wasn't commissioned for the HMC, but was purchased at the suggestion of Mr. Whitlam himself after he'd had won the Archibald Prize. And interestingly, it's probably one of the least realist portraits in the collection. I think it tends to divide opinion a little bit. The HMC, in terms of its artistic style, is relatively conservative. Most of the portraits are very realist paintings, whereas this one is probably stretching the boundaries almost as far as they've ever been stretched. I think it's a very fine work. Probably the thing that I like most of about it is this very expansive hand gesture in the painting, which just gives it a sense of dynamism and movement. Some of them can be very static. And I think that's probably part of what helped it win the prize. The Archibald was known for a very long time, like the HMC collection, for being a rather conservative prize. But in the last 30 years or so, they seem to have really stretched the boundaries a lot more. As I mentioned earlier, women are very much in the minority in the HMC, both as subjects and artists. However, they do appear from time to time. The first two portraits depicting women were William Dargie's portrait of Dame Enid Lyons, completed in 1951, and Archie Calhoun's portrait of Dame Dorothy Tangney from 1946. These portraits commemorate their respective status as the first woman member of the House and the first woman senator in the Australian Parliament. Some of the significant women artists who are represented in the collection include Judy Kassab, who painted her portrait of Speaker James Cope in 1973 and also painted Chief Justice Sir Harry Gibbs in 1992, and June Mendoza, who painted this distinctively informal portrait of John Gorton in 1971 and also painted Speaker Billy Snedden in 1984. Mendoza also painted the first sitting of the House of Representatives in this building in 1988, and it's another painting that you can see just outside here. There was another very early woman artist in the collection, a lady called Florence Rodway. She painted a couple of portraits, I think, in the 1920s, but generally they're very much in the minority. After the early flush of enthusiasm in the period between 1912 and 1920, two world wars and the Great Depression intervened and limited the capacity of the Historic Memorials Committee to meet regularly. Constrained finances also affected the rate at which new portraits were commissioned. But despite this, the collection continued to grow, with the primary focus remaining, as I've said, largely on political figures. Portraits of all Governors General, Chief Justices of the High Court, Prime Ministers and Presiding Officers of the Parliament have been acquired. In addition to that core group, portraits of other important figures have occasionally been added, such as monarchs, some early explorers and literary figures, and paintings depicting special events, such as the opening of Parliament in Canberra in 1927 and the opening of the new Parliament House, this building, in 1988. Portraits have also been commissioned or purchased of individuals who in some manner represent a parliamentary first, such as the first women, who we've already seen, Dame Enid Lyons and Dame Dorothy Tangney, as well as the first Indigenous Australian elected to Parliament, Neville Bonner, whose portrait was painted in 1979 by Wes Walters. Again, a fairly unusual portrait. I assume it's a deliberate thing that he's put this sort of layer of white just from the head upwards behind Bonner, presumably to emphasise the fact that he's a dark-skinned man, I guess making a point about the fact that he was the first Indigenous Member of Parliament. Today, the Historic Memorials Collection includes almost 250 artworks. The majority are portraits by eminent Australian artists. In addition to the names I've already listed, the HMC includes works by Julian Ashton, George Lambert, John Longstaff, William McInnes and Ivor Hill. Other significant artists commissioned more recently include Albert Tucker, Sam Fulbrook, Bill Leake, Peter Churcher, Paul Newton, Jiawei Shen and Rick Amor. Male artists and male subjects are still dominant, but with a female Prime Minister and a female Governor-General currently in office, the numbers of women represented in the collection will soon be boosted. As well as recording Australia's political history, the collection also reveals changes in the history of portraiture in Australia. As we've seen from this quick selection, the earlier portraits were often sombre in tone and reflected the dignity of the office held by the sitter. Sorry, I've just lost my order of pages. And they borrowed heavily from European formal portraiture traditions. Over time, portraits have tended to become less formal and capture more of the personality of their sitters, sometimes including objects with personal associations as well as the regalia of office. The Historic Memorials Collection is a valuable and continuing record of the history of politics and portraiture in Australia. Its centenary provides an opportunity to reflect on the way individual political leaders are portrayed. And I would remind you of the quote from Tom Roberts, from which I've taken the title of this presentation, where he talks about, in his recommendation to Deakin, about the importance of making faithful representations. It gives us an opportunity to consider how political leaders are portrayed and how they are viewed by the broader community that the Parliament represents. I hope you can all find some time to look at some of the portraits in the collection. A large number of them are here at Parliament House, and there are also some at Old Parliament House, the High Court, and the National Portrait Gallery. And that's it for me. I finished a bit early.
Thank you for a wonderfully informative lecture. That was just fantastic. I'd like to open up the floor to anyone that might have any questions for Kylie. Yes, of course. There's a microphone.
We do know he travelled widely, so he visited a number of states in Australia to meet with the people who were the representatives of those. I gather some people were not very happy about the idea. There have even been suggestions that they might have tried to cajole him into reducing their girth, for instance. I suspect there would be some figures who he wouldn't have done that with in that literal a sense, particularly the Duke of Cornwall, who opened the proceedings. Although Roberts made sketches at the event, he also had a couple of sittings with the Duke in England before the painting was completed. I would imagine it was much more just a case of using his artist's eye with some of the more important dignitaries. But I gather there are notebooks where he made sketches. I think they're mostly held at the National Library and recorded some of those details like height and weight and hair colour, eye colour, those sorts of things.
Yes, I was about to say, so there's a microphone just behind you there.
Would it be correct to say that before a portrait is commissioned, there's a sort of assessment that someone's career is substantially complete?
Yes, but not always. You mean the subject's career, not the artist's career? Yeah. Generally, the preference is, if possible, to have the portrait painted while the subject is still in office so that it closely represents the way they looked while they were in that office. But obviously, when you're dealing with people like Prime Ministers in particular or Chief Justices, they have pretty busy schedules, so that's not always feasible. And certainly there are a substantial number of portraits that have been painted immediately after someone has left office. And in the case of, say, Prime Minister Harold Holt, who left office rather suddenly, obviously that portrait had to be painted posthumously. And some of the earlier ones as well, where they only decided to begin the collection after people had passed away, like Sir Henry Parkes. In those cases, what usually happened was they made an effort to obtain good quality photographic portraits of the people, and then those were given to the artists.
Madam, did you...
We've seen a very conservative collection of portraits, apart from the Clifton Pugh one of Gough Whitlam. Has that been controversial amongst the selection committee, that sometimes an artist may have been regarded as a little bit too avant-garde or a little bit too untraditional?
Occasionally. There are rare examples, not a lot of them, but there are occasional examples of portraits being submitted and being rejected by the committee. Surprisingly, the ones that most often got returned for rework were the earliest ones, where I would say they were pretty conservative anyway, but obviously the standards they were being judged against were even more conservative then than our tastes would be now. So, for instance, Tom Roberts did a portrait of Tennyson that I mentioned, which was sent back to him for rework, which I think is, you know, a bit presumptuous considering the stature he would have had as an artist at that time, and considering the, you know, what we now see in the finished portrait, it's hard to imagine what they could have been finding fault with. But George Lambert, who was probably one of the more, I guess, avant-garde artists of that early era, he painted a portrait of Sir George Read, I think in about 1914 or 15, where, unlike most of the other early ones, he wasn't standing, he was seated. And if any of you are familiar with George Read, he was a reasonably large man, had a nice round tummy. Because he's seated, that's very much emphasised in the portrait, and I think actually one of the news clippings I show might have made reference to it. But there was a lot of both public consternation and consternation amongst the committee. I think this second one on the right refers to it. I'm not sure if you can read it. I'll just read it to you. The matter of Sir George Read's portrait, now hanging in Queen's Hall, was mentioned, and it was decided that Mr. Longstaff should be approached in order to ascertain the price of his picture of Sir George Read. So basically they commissioned a second, or they obtained a second portrait because Lambert's was described as being too much of a caricature of the man. There were a couple of other later artists as well whose portraits were rejected. Probably the other best known example was the first portrait done of Sir John Kerr by a Queensland artist called Sam Fulbrook, a terrific artist, but not necessarily a painter of realist likenesses. And so that portrait was rejected without Sir John Kerr ever having any input into the decision, and a second portrait was obtained.
Up the back, Nick.
Were any actually rejected by the subject?
There was one, I believe, yes. Malcolm Fraser's first portrait, he expressed considerable concern about. That was painted by Brian Westwood, one of the artists that we looked at. I gather the main concern was, again, it was a standing portrait, highly realist, I think the view that was expressed was that it made Malcolm Fraser look like a very intimidating character, probably a highly accurate representation of the way he was when he was Prime Minister. I think his persona is quite different now. Although the Visual Arts Board, who by then were playing the role of the Commonwealth Art Advisory Board, they had endorsed it as an acceptable portrait, and a number of the members of the Historic Memorials Committee had endorsed it. Because of Mr. Fraser's concerns, the committee were eventually persuaded that a second portrait should be obtained.
Yes, sir, in the middle.
Yep.
G'day, thanks for your really interesting talk. Just wanted to ask, how do you see the place of the Historic Memorials Collection in the overall conceptual basis of the art programme for Parliament House? And in the 4 years that you've been here, are you aware of any changes in attitudes towards its relative importance vis-à-vis the rest of the collection, or any changes that you're aware of since the building opened in 1988?
Not significant changes, I would say. Just to go back a step, when this building was being built, there were a number of committees that were involved in various decision-making processes relating to this building, and the sort of overall role was played by a joint standing committee of parliamentarians who were established to manage the process. They did a lot of the work on briefing the architects, that sort of thing. For those of you who don't know, the art collection in Parliament House is considered to be very much an integral central part of the building, so it wasn't added as an afterthought. It was sort of developed as a concept right through the whole process of the architecture being developed. The Joint Standing Committee took advice from a body, I think it was called the Presiding Officer's Reference Advisory Group, about a thing that they called the locational listing, and there was also an Art Advisory Group, a separate body to the Parliament House Construction Authority. So all these sort of groups of different people with different backgrounds and perspectives provided input to the Joint Standing Committee. But that committee eventually developed what they called the locational listing, which included an item-by-item inventory of material from Old Parliament House that they determined should either be left there or brought to this building. And the majority of the Historic Memorials Committee portraits were deemed to be needed for this building because they so much represent the history of the Parliament. Of course, at that stage, the Museum of Australian Democracy at Old Parliament House hadn't been established, and there was a degree of uncertainty about what might happen to that building. But in particular, the placement of the portraits around the Members' Hall was something that was decided and committed to very early on. And has remained constant. We have made some minor changes, in particular the number of Prime Minister's portraits that can be displayed in the public areas of this building is relatively limited because we're constrained by the number of wall slots. There used to be only 12 of them on display, but a couple of years ago there was some concern that the portrait of John Curtin was about to be displaced so that another portrait could hang, and in response to the sort of public concern about that, we put a proposal to the presiding officers that we could relocate some of the other portraits to provide more space for prime ministers. So we now have 16 portraits of former prime ministers on public display. And the parliamentary firsts, as we call them, who used to be in Members' Hall, are now further out the front of the building. So I would say minor adjustments. But I think generally, particularly for the members of Parliament themselves, those of them with a strong interest and commitment to parliamentary history would always see it as an essential thing that the core of the Historic Memorials collection is displayed here. But we're lucky, of course, that we have institutions like the High Court and the Portrait Gallery and Old Parliament House now who can also display the ones that can't be displayed here. Yes?
Thank you. You've just mentioned the High Court and the portraits that are there are absolutely stunning, but I have to make a comment that they're so high up the wall that the actual plaques that go with them, with providing information, cannot be read. You have to literally climb a ladder to see them. And I don't know, is that something that you can address, or does it have to be done through the High Court, which I can do?
It is something that the High Court would have to address, but I can tell you it's something they're looking into themselves, and I think probably within the next few months that should be addressed. I suppose it does illustrate the difference, though, of a building where the artworks were added later, almost as an afterthought, compared to this building where the building was very much designed with display of art as part of its purpose.
Do you see a time when the portraits will be replaced by digital images?
I don't think so. I mean, it's really interesting. Even back in 1911, when the collection was first established, there was talk about acquiring photographic portraits as well, and busts in stone. But curiously, although they did acquire photographic images to use as references, particularly where a portrait was being painted of someone who wasn't alive anymore, they've never really been retained as part of the core collection, so they were only ever used for reference purposes, not as a sort of substantial part of the collection. I think there's still something about a painted portrait that provides a degree of distance, perhaps, and also maybe just makes it a bit more special, I suppose. I mean, if you go to the National Portrait Gallery, you will see they certainly acquire portraits in a much broader range of media. They have things like textiles, lots of photographic portraits, relief images, that sort of thing. The sort of prescription, the technical prescription, if you like, for portrait commissions is still very, very controlled in that they have to be oil paintings on canvas, they have to be within a certain size range, they have to be framed in a manner that's considered to be suitable for the collection, that sort of thing. And there's certainly no push at this point to change it. I suppose the only thing that might change is eventually there might be less people painting portraits, but there's no sign of that happening yet. There are plenty of competent portrait artists around still to take these sorts of commissions on.
Yes, I'm sorry.
If I heard you right and recalled it correctly, I think you said that the big picture was in the Royal Collection and lent back to us.
Yes.
So my question is, how does it come to pass that such an important picture is in the Royal Collection and not here? And how did it come to pass that it came back here?
Okay.
And while I'm on that subject, are there any other really significant items like that that we know of that are held somewhere overseas? And just say what we're doing about them.
Okay. The answer to the first part of the question is, strangely enough, the big picture was a private commission. So it was a group of Melbourne businessmen who I think called themselves something like the Australian Art Association, basically undertook to offer this commission, and they were the ones who set out some of the basic requirements, like that it had to include accurate likenesses of a large number of the people there. Various historians have suggested that their primary motivation was in fact commercial. There were photogravure reproductions made of the big picture, so mass-produced print forms of it, and sold widely, not only in Australia but all around the world. They were produced by a French printing company who sort of specialised in that kind of thing. So it has been suggested that, in fact, the group of people who commissioned the work weren't really that interested in a major commemorative artwork. They were looking for something to form the basis of a cheaper commercial product that they could then exploit. But in any case, when the painting was completed, that group of businessmen presented it as a gift to the King, so King Edward, who had become monarch just before Parliament opened when Queen Victoria died, but he wasn't at the opening. He sent his, I think, his second son. And so the collection, so the portrait was sent off to England to the collection, and from what we can gather, it stayed in St James Palace until the 1950s. There were occasional rumblings about the fact that it was there and not here, and that really came to a head in the 1950s when Dame Dorothy Tangney in particular lobbied Prime Minister Menzies very hard to advocate for its return, and there was a lot of, you know, to-ing and fro-ing about all of this. Menzies eventually engaged the secretary of the Governor-General. I can't tell you who that was at the time, but the secretary then undertook to get the Governor-General to write to the palace saying, you know, we think this is a really important part of Australia's history. Would there be any scope of returning it to Australia? The response of the palace or the royal household was that because it had been a gift, they wouldn't re-give the gift, but that it would be offered on permanent loan. And so for the last 53 years, it's been here. The sad thing was that when it finally came back to Australia in 1958, I don't think they'd quite anticipated just how big it was. And it was actually quite difficult to find anywhere big enough to hang it. So it did spend a little bit of time in the old Parliament House, I gather, on display. And it also did a little tour of some of the major state galleries. But it spent quite a lot of time languishing in storage because there was nowhere big enough to show it until the High Court... And then the High Court, when their new building opened in 1980 or 81, I think it was, finally there was a big concrete wall, and it was there until this building opened. But as you can see when you look at the place where it's located here, again, the architects consciously designed a space for its display. So the area where that little balcony is and the curved wall, it architecturally it echoes the sort of visual references. Have I got the picture here?
Madam?
Kylie, this is not directly relevant, but it might be of interest to the gentleman there. In 1927, the Duchess of York was given a book of sketches by Irene Mort, and they were sketches of Canberra. And in relation to the centenary of the naming of Canberra in 2013, I wondered if we could get them back for an exhibition, and any other pictures that they, or works that they have of Canberra. Have we ever investigated what they have of Canberra in there in England?
It's not something we've looked into. It's possible some of the other institutions may have.
I don't think they know about it. I think that's the thing. But anyway, maybe not for 2013, but someday I think we'll get some of those works back again on loan.
I guess the big picture is proof that these things won't happen quickly, but they're not impossible.
Yes.
In the case of the big picture, it was probably about 4 or 5 years of, you know, to-ing and fro-ing correspondence at various levels, but eventually, you know, it did happen. And there's no push to take it back.
I think we have time for one more question.
I'm not particularly aware of any, although there may be. I don't know if there was something you had in mind in terms of other works that might be in other places that we should be trying to repatriate. No.
On that note, may I thank you all very much for joining us for today's lecture. I think you'll agree it's been absolutely fascinating, and I feel much better educated than when I walked in the door this afternoon. So thank you, and we look forward to seeing you at next month's lecture.
Thank you.